Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. Congratulations. Ye who are still standing. We've had many losses this retreat. But the stalwarts are still here. The flu has attacked us. Doubt. This is an experiment that we tried. Marion invited me to try to teach a retreat here, and that's very traditional that the Sangha doesn't teach until it's invited. That's the sort of appropriate relationship rather than proselytizing and so on. So it's a kind of an experiment for Tisarana. I'm trying to see how we can do a partial residential, non-residential retreat. Certainly is a beautiful environment, and we were very, very fortunate with the weather. Health-wise, well, many struggled with the flu. The great bodhisattvas in the kitchen. Bhikkhus organizing things, so I feel very fortunate. Nice to practice with you. One of the word Sangha now is used by lay people. In ancient tradition, Sangha wasn't used by the lay people. So there was usually Bhikkhu Sangha or Arya Sangha. And it's become a kind of word which is used by people, I think anyone who kind of meditates together, it's my Sangha. As a bhikkhu, to be a part of the bhikkhu Sangha, it requires quite a huge commitment to use that word. Just take the training that to become a bhikkhu, say Venerable Attila was 1 year as an anagarika, 1 year as a samanera, and both bhikkhus, and a lot of hard work and renunciation to be a part of the bhikkhu sangha. And so, I think when lay people use that word, you should try to consider: does it have what would give that word more depth than just an association of meditators? What would give that word more power? I think most, like when you look at the texts, the way much of the teaching is to the ordained Sangha, to the Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni Sangha, and I guess lay people can extrapolate from that what the Buddha thought was important and how to develop a lifestyle, because the lay lifestyle was laid out in rather general terms. Five precepts, eight precepts, Sigalavada Sutta, various kinds of references to responsibility to one's elders and to one's children, and but they're general suggestions, whereas the suggestions to the Bhikkhu Sangha are very, very specific and very, very detailed. And so perhaps if one is going to use the word Sangha, as a layperson, one should consider what does that mean in terms of commitment and responsibility. Is it a word I can just use willy-nilly? if it implied some responsibility, that might be, that would certainly give that word more importance, give that association more importance. The bhikkhu sangha, we take the Dhamma Vinaya as our way of life, and the Vinaya is a kind of responsibility we have to live in a certain way, and we don't really have rights as such, but all the bhikkhus have the same responsibility. So if one bhikkhu is being irresponsible, then he's censured for that, and so the sangha is protected from misbehavior and selfishness and so on through the rules. But the rules are set up as a system of training and a series of responsibilities, types of responsibilities. So that might be a good way to look at what lay sangha might mean, if you're going to use that word. So first and foremost, it would, if it were a Buddhist sangha, then it would imply a sense of confidence in the Buddha's awakening, a sense of trust and confidence and faith in the Buddha's awakening, because his teaching comes from his awakening, from his enlightenment. So if we're going to call it a Buddhist sangha. Doctrinally, it would probably imply belief in rebirth. Belief in the law of karma, these kinds of things. So if you took those together, law of karma, rebirth, the Buddha's awakening, his enlightenment, then that would... there would be a commitment then to... There'd be a commitment to follow the path that the Buddha suggested, for the reason that he suggested, and the reason he suggested was enlightenment. That his awakening, his enlightenment, was a kind of signpost for all of us, that there is this possible human endeavor to realize. So it seems to me that would be a part of a Buddhist sangha, that it would have direction. And the direction would not be just limited to some kind of social group, but it would be focused on individual enlightenment. And that's not being selfish, it's just putting emphasis where emphasis is important, because you can only do it yourself, I can only do it myself. No one can do this work for us. We can support each other. But as you all see in this retreat, each of us has a different set of circumstances we're dealing with day by day, hour by hour. So then, if it were a Buddhist sangha, then that would mean that being part of the sangha implies a commitment to the path, to cultivate the path, to pick up the ideas that Buddha suggested for the cultivation of the path. So it wouldn't just be arbitrarily sitting to get peaceful. It wouldn't just be for stress release. Those are good things, but if one is going to take the meaning of that word deeply, so it wouldn't be just about chilling out with a group of people. There'd be a deeper aspiration there. So then within that kind of aspiration, then one would begin to see that one's duty, one has a certain duty and responsibility to this teaching. rather than it just being something that one picks up, rather than just picking up those bits that feel comfortable. Because if it were that, if I just picked up the bits that were comfortable, then it would not be really Buddhist Sangha. It would be idiosyncratic Sangha, my personal preferences and my sort of buffet of choices. Then I don't think you could call that a Buddhist Sangha. So in terms of like responsibilities or duties, then of course you reflect on the moral social responsibility that the Buddha says we should undertake. And of course those are defined by the precepts, a life of generosity, and relationships which are mutually helpful, husband to wife, children to kids. And one of the simplest ways to look at that responsibility is the undertaking of the golden rule. That's a very beautiful way to contemplate our social life or life in relationship. And the golden rule is do unto others as you would have done unto you. Don't do unto others that which you wouldn't want done to you. And that's a very, very profound way to live your life. So if you take, it's very obvious, the first precept, I don't want to be killed. Nobody wants to get killed. No one wants to be oppressed by fear of death. So it's an act of kindness to other beings, and ultimately kindness to myself. So just corruption of various sorts, the second precept, do unto others as you would have done unto you. If you've ever been robbed, I lived in India, I lived in the mountains a year as a layman, and I had a little stone cabin, very rustic. And I went down to Delhi to do some business or something, changed some traveler's checks, and I came back and someone had broken into my little shack. Didn't have much, but they had pretty much ripped it apart. And the feeling was awful, really awful. I wasn't as cool as the Zen monk who looks at the moon and says, "Oh, they forgot the moon." I was quite upset. And you know, when something happens to, you know, when something bad like that happens to one, the reflection is, if you're taking the golden rule, I'm not going to do that to others. It's a beautiful way to process something which is really negative in social relationships. Someone does something which is quite painful and hurtful, and you absorb it. And socially you have to deal with it, you have to call their number, whatever, that's another issue. But just at the heart level, wow, that really hurts, and I'm not going to do that to others. Rather than, you know, revenge and all the rest of it. So the third precept, promiscuity, infidelity, all those kinds of things. People come to me and they talk about some of that stuff, and I'm glad I'm celibate. Just so painful. And the realm of relationships and sexuality, it's a very emotional realm. It's really up and down and a powerful realm. So to be faithful in relationships, to not use sexuality in a kind of indulgent way, to not harm people with sexuality, and so on and so forth. And then the third precept has a wider context, and it's the context of sensuality. So like the whole realm of hedonism that our culture so beautifully promotes. so seductively supports and encourages and so on. So there's just the kind of a responsibility to guard one's senses, because a mind which is hedonistic and very much caught up in externalities, in sense experience, is a mind which will never be peaceful and never realize the goal. So if one is really serious about being a part of a Buddhist Sangha, then that aspiration to realize the goal is serious. And then the sense of renunciation becomes obvious. I think most of us know that, but it's always good to reflect on it. Just a sense of not going out all the time into sense experience, coming home to the heart, and that the sense of you're kind of restraining the senses is very skillful. And then the precept on right speech, that's a very good one to reflect using the golden rule. Someone, you hear someone is gossiping about you and putting you down behind your back, and you think, oh, I thought they were my friend. That's very painful, isn't it? Someone breaks trust like that. So you say to yourself, I'm going to get them. No. You say to yourself, I'm not going to do that to others. And that's a lovely way to proceed. And, I mean, that's a lifetime's work. So just the way we communicate, making real effort not to hurt others, to be straight if you have to, obviously, but to have the kind of empathy to others to say, is this appropriate? Like, is my opinion right now really necessary? I was reading something called, the author called it the fetish of assertion, where everyone has to assert their opinion. Just, you know, like, so what? Just because you have an opinion, does everyone have to know about it? Like the whole, these people that campaign for animal rights, and someone has a fur coat and they're attacked. My mother, she had a mink coat. She couldn't wear it because she was afraid she'd get attacked. You know, that kind of insensitivity where people become very self-righteous and very self-important. Come up to people who are smoking, you shouldn't be smoking. That's the kind of awfulness of human conceit, isn't it? At least I think so. So the kind of speech which is like guarded and sensitive and appropriate to time and place, rather than just having to shove my opinion in just to tell someone something, that kind of insensitivity can become very, very painful. And then the precept on sobriety, just the lowering of intelligence that grass or alcohol, they all make you stupid. So just a kind of sense of guarding one's own consciousness. So that, like, and so a Buddhist Sangha would have a sense of responsibility to those, to that way of relating, a kind of duty to live by those precepts. So if someone wasn't and was just taking up their own kind of preceptual lifestyle, then I don't think you could call it a real Buddhist lifestyle, Buddhist Sangha. And then the whole ethos of generosity, think about that, how just like Anoma and Priyani feeding us and Philip running around and making sure I'm okay in all kinds of ways. This is very much a Buddhist Sangha, isn't it? Rather than I just want to meditate for me, leave me alone, I'm trying to get enlightened, you cook. So that kind of spirit of generosity is a kind of, I guess responsibility is not a good word for generosity, but you see what I mean. that it's an important part of a Buddhist Sangha, rather than a bunch of people just kind of getting, you know, trying to get their meditation space and leave me alone. So that would be, it's also like a Sangha is a group that has a common thread, that has a common aspiration, that has a common morality, a common ethic that we all agree upon. So as bhikkhus, we agree upon a refined code of etiquette, and quite often we question each other, what's exactly, is that allowed? Is vegetable broth in the evening allowed? Or what do we do if someone gives us something which we want to pass on to a charity? Is that allowed? So we have this kind of constant little dialogue going on about some of our rules. We're always kind of checking. And we all live by that, the same rule. You know, we all have given up to that, have surrendered to that, have a responsibility to that. And so that's very, very helpful for harmony. It's a very beautiful way of functioning. So then it seems to me a lay sangha should have that same kind of common social groundwork that is agreed upon, not because it was invented by the leader of a lay sangha, but because the Buddha presented it that way and tradition presents it that way. That's beautiful. Then it's not egotistical. It's not selfish. It's something that we all give ourselves to. And then from that, there's tremendous trust, right? Tremendous sense of common aspiration and a common commitment. So then if it were to be a Buddhist Sangha and one is developing the path, then one would have to include samadhi, some sense of mind training, that there'd be a commitment to that and a responsibility to that. If one takes this word seriously, and that means a commitment to actually doing formal practices of meditation, times of formal meditation, to make that very high priority rather than something that is slipped in at an odd day when life seems to be amenable to some meditation. So the kind of making that very, very important, making meditation very important in one's life, to me, seems to be what Sangha would be about too, rather than not giving it any priority, putting it low down on the list, making it something that you only do occasionally. So then the kind of responsibility or duty to sit and meditate, I mean, it's a beautiful responsibility, but sometimes life is such, has so many urgencies and so many things to do that we neglect that to our own detriment, to the detriment of our culture, I think. So the training of the mind, as you notice on a retreat, it's not easy to focus the mind, to calm the mind, and stay with the object of meditation, and to stay with the routine of meditation is a considerable challenge, and it does require sustained effort. It requires time. Doesn't come as an accident. It requires a craft. It requires a steady application of mind, day in and day out, day in and day out, day in and day out, over many years to get really settled into it. So that would be important in kind of defining a Buddhist Sangha. I suppose that's probably what Sangha usually refers to, is that meditative part. Like now, you've got some momentum in your practice. You've been diligent and done sitting, walking, and so there's a sort of grounding there, which has you know, it's not easy. You've worked at it, so it would be good to not just squander that or waste that, but to build on that, to sustain that. So the way to develop a sitting practice is to make determinations to actually sit. So to develop sitting practice is something very important, and make room for it in your life and make determinations to do that. So this is intentionality, right thought, developing the path, right intention, and intention then it begins to guide you on this path, and it's the way you're steering this vehicle now. So to make intentions as the retreat ends to try to sustain formal practice, to do it reasonably. If you say you're going to go home and do 5 hours a day, and very few people have that much time, but to make it a serious commitment, make the determination while you're here, and then when you get back home, do it. Don't say, oh well. And the best time to meditate is when you go home and you think you've meditated enough. Get right into it. Don't say, oh well, I've just had a retreat. I don't need to meditate. I've just done so much meditation. I think I'll go to Tim Hortons and have a donut. You can do that too. But to like see this opportunity now, this rare, I mean, how many times, we may never come together like this again. It's a very rare opportunity. So to seize that opportunity and then build on it. So when you go home, if your mind starts to negotiate why you shouldn't meditate, don't believe it. Just meditate. Keep it going. Keep that strength going. So kind of making that important. And then finally, if it were to be a Buddhist Sangha, you have to have a commitment to Dhamma. Commitment to awakening to the way things are. So there'd be a commitment to the formal structures that the Buddha offers us from the Pali Canon, from this tradition, if this is a tradition you like. So Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, three characteristics, entrances to samadhi and fetters and so on and so forth. But deeper than that, it's a commitment to be really honest about what's going on and to wake up to it and to begin to contemplate the way things are. Really contemplate what's arising in consciousness, how it is, how it changes, how it arises and ceases. That kind of commitment to constantly awaken and know the way things are, which is a commitment to mindfulness, really, isn't it? A commitment to do things in a sense of presence and to not waste time. Not waste time. Life is life. Strange one with the Buddhist teachings around birth and death. The summum bonum is the end of birth and death. So birth is always suffering, old age, sickness and death. But birth also, in Buddhist way of thinking, is also this incredible opportunity, human birth especially. Human birth is this amazing opportunity, especially if you come across the Dhamma, to reflect and discover what the Buddha discovered. So to waste human birth by just fritting the time away would be considered foolish indeed. So this human birth is very valuable, and how many years have we got left? With that flu, I don't know, knocked a few years off. You don't know. So really that kind of taking, quite often we take life seriously when someone close to us dies. or we get sick or whatever, but to make, like, really infuse your life with Dharma reflection day in and day out, just make that really, really important. Politics, economics, art, they're all fine. It can be interesting, but make the Dhamma that kind of heart of your intellectual life, the heart of your contemplative life, and so that all activities become a chance to contemplate Dhamma, whether it's a committee meeting or it's weeding the garden or dealing with traffic jams or having the flu or whatever. It's all really Dhamma. And that's a kind of commitment to wisdom, commitment to insight, commitment to understanding the way things are. And so you go back to the Four Noble Truths, that if there's some kind of conflict in your heart, not just a social conflict, because sometimes social conflicts, you're okay with them because you realize that's not your karma, you just have to be patient with it. But inwardly, whether there's some sense of disease or lack or confusion or fear or self-disparagement or some mode of greed or anxiety or lust or, you know, whatever the form of friction that takes place, that's what you go to. That's what you bring that up into consciousness and say, why am I suffering? Because this leads to understanding. Why can't I be at ease with this person? Why do I have to make this thing a problem? Why do I hold on? Why does my mind get so preoccupied with this stuff? What is it? Why? And then that's not just a sort of endless wheel of analysis. It's more like looking at your heart, at your body, at your intentions. So the whole problem of human preoccupation with the trivial or the confused or the fearful, that we begin to just constantly awaken to, what is my mind preoccupied with? Is it really important? Is it conducive to Nibbana? Or is it just a bad habit? And how do I let go? How do I let go of these unnecessary preoccupations? Some things we have to preoccupy ourselves with. We need to get the snow cleared if it's snowing, or need to get the done up by 11 o'clock and so on. But those are activities that are natural. But the kind of inner preoccupation where we're, even if we're doing something good, we're preoccupied with some resentment or sense of hopelessness or doubt or self-despair, these kinds of things, continually awaken to that. Just break it open. Don't believe in it. Just say, not me, not mine. Not me, not mine. Unsure. Keep letting go, letting go, letting go. So that the mind breaks free from these preoccupations, so that the mind has some sense of spaciousness and peace from all that business. So ultimately, I think, the Buddhist Sangha has a responsibility to be happy, but not just the happiness of distraction, trivial pursuits, but the more profound realization of Nibbana, of that kind of spiritual goal. So it would be good to. It would be a shame to see that word gets lost as just a kind of mundane word, which doesn't have any real that the word sangha gets lost and hasn't got the kind of a sense of commitment which that word implies. That it was just used in a kind of just as because the word can be used as group, it means group basically. But it would be good to have it as a kind of word of aspiration, a word of commitment, a word of something that has more power and more meaning in it. Okay, I'll leave that for tonight.